listens to watch it. So if water could do this, it changes shape based on what it hears. Imagine a human being.
Right. That's very thought-provoking, actually, dear Said. Mm. We will unfortunately have to end today's discussion on that note. Thank you for joining us on the program, dear listeners. And as usual, if you have any questions, comments, or just some feedback, please write us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit us at our website, Pars Today. Thank you for joining us, and until another program, Allah bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Though U.S. forces have left Afghanistan, the war could continue with remotely controlled drone strikes and even less accountability. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Murtaza Hussein, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. drone strike in Kabul killed a family and began a new chapter of war. Stay tuned for more. The recent drone strike in Kabul, initially claimed by U.S. officials to have destroyed a car packed with multiple suicide bombers, reportedly killed 10 civilians from one family, including several children. The drone strike that hit Khaja Berga, a working-class residential neighborhood in Kabul, was said to have killed numerous members of Ahmadi family, with the youngest alleged victim being a 2-year-old girl. Morgue footage shared on social media showed the burnt bodies of several children as well as photos of the victims before their deaths. One of the dead, according to members of the Ahmadi family who spoke to reporters, was a former Afghan military officer who had served as a contractor for U.S. forces as well as a worker at a charity organization. The Americans said the airstrike killed Daesh members. A neighbor of the family angrily told reporters after the strike, referring to Daesh. Where is Daesh here? Were these children Daesh? The U.S. Defense Department and other arms of the Biden administration continue to describe the drone attack as a successful strike against Daesh, which had taken responsibility for a suicide bombing at a Kabul airport. As reports confirm that an innocent family had been killed, Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said that the Department of Defense is not in a position to dispute reports that civilians were killed, stating that the incident would be investigated. The Kabul drone strike is just one in a long string of attacks in Afghanistan by U.S. forces and their proxies, reported to have killed large numbers of civilians. Past attacks have hit families traveling in cars and buses, wedding parties, hospitals filled with patients, and groups of farmers working in the fields. While the withdrawal of American troops can be described as the end to the war in Afghanistan, the Kabul strike shows how the war may simply enter a new chapter, with the U.S. striking targets with aircraft launched from faraway drone bases. Critics of civilian casualties in U.S. war have pointed to the lack of serious investigations on the ground to the deaths, accountability that will even harder to come by in a remote war. The drone program is opaque, with extremely limited accountability for anyone involved. In my experience, the bar for thorough military investigation has been so high as to discount a majority of credible incidents. What investigations do take place are neither consistent rigors, said Nick McDonnell, author of The Bodies in Person, an account of civilian casualties in American wars, an analysis of the impact of the U.S. air wars in the West Asia region, adding, at the same time, the military has repeatedly suppressed information on civilian casualties. The drone program is opaque, with extremely limited accountability for anyone involved. What separated the recent Kabul drone strike from the long pattern of reported civilian deaths was the level of immediate attention and outrage it has generated. The U.S. war in Afghanistan has mostly been waged in rural areas away from the attention of international media. Kabul, on the other hand, is the highly populated capital and the country's center for expatriates, non-governmental organizations, and both Afghan as well as international journalists. When the strike was reported, immediate video footage of the civilians who were killed in the attack began to circulate, and even international journalists were able to quickly access the attack site. In contrast, many past strikes have gone under the radar and continue to do so. A retaliatory strike that came immediately after the recent terrorist attack at Hamid Karzai International Airport hit rural eastern Afghanistan, allegedly killing two people, an ISIS planner and a facilitator, according to the Defense Department. At a press briefing recently, Kirby declined to share further information about the identities of the two people allegedly killed in that prior attack. Other than dedicated Afghanistan observers, few took notice. Journalists and rights advocates have so far not reported any details of on-the-ground investigations or if such investigations are even possible. The opaque nature of the war in Afghanistan has made calculating accurate death tolls from U.S. operations difficult, a challenge that has been compounded by the military's own long-standing refusal to compile statistics and verify information about who is killed in its strikes. The secretive nature of the war on terror in general, across all its various theaters of operation, coupled with military practices that devote little attention to strike investigations, makes assessing civilian impact nearly impossible. The U.S. military's own promises to investigate civilian casualty incidents have resulted in little meaningful accountability in the past. According to its standard practices, the military does not conduct site visits to learn who was killed in its airstrikes, leaving the grueling work of finding out who died and why to independent monitoring organizations and investigative journalists who operate with far fewer resources than a Pentagon. The Washington Post reported recently that as airstrikes ramped up in the final years of the Afghanistan war, the number of strikes investigated by the military for civilian casualties plummeted. Few outside the areas impacted would have taken notice of many of the strikes at all, let alone the absence of investigations. In those cases in which the military did launch its own inquiries, the findings were viewed with skepticism. These investigations are nothing but advertisements to the media, a local council official from Helmand province in Afghanistan told the Post. They have no mercy. They only see targets to kill. The Kabul airstrike, though, generated an outpouring of grief and anger among many Afghans, already reeling from the Taliban takeover of their country following the collapse of the U.S.-backed central government. Though the Pentagon has promised to hold itself accountable for such incidents, experts on the drone war say that there is little reason, based on the past practice, to expect meaningful justice for the victims. Hena Shamsi, director of the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project, said the failure to properly acknowledge, investigate, or compensate civilian deaths and injuries is one constant of U.S. airstrikes, whether in recognized wars like Afghanistan or outside of them, like in Somalia, adding, the specific reasons and the agencies involved in those failures may differ in each context. And over 20 years, we have repeatedly seen legal and policy debates and promises by the U.S. governments to do better. But that's of little comfort to the civilians on the receiving end of American lethal force, who suffer terrible harm with little or no transparency and accountability.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. There is perhaps no doubt that the transnational criminal syndicates and networks undermine the stability and security of all nations through their illicit enterprises, including the transshipment of drugs, arms, illegal contraband, trafficked women and children, laundered money, financial fraud, counterfeiting, and cybercrime. In the first part of the documentary, we saw that behind the supply of illicit goods and services is often a web of international organized crime. The interwoven strands of such illicit and criminal transactions make it almost impossible to separate one from the other. International criminals have tremendous financial resources and spare no expense to corrupt government and law enforcement officials. They also have extensive worldwide networks to support their operations and are inherently nimble, adapting quickly to change. Stay with us as we further investigate these issues in the second part of the documentary.
Villas and castles, luxury hotels, real estate, bank accounts. The range of riches seized each year by the Italian justice system makes one dizzy. In 2010, it was over 9 billion euros, nearly 5 billion in 2011. It gives some idea of the financial clout of organized crime. And this is just in Italy. Money laundering is at the heart of the mafia infiltration. On Rome's Via Vivento, the Café de Paris is a showpiece. Photos of Mastroianni or Fellini decorate the walls.
But now the ghost of the 'Ndrangheta boss haunts it. After months of investigation, Italian investigators discovered that this cult symbol of the Dolce Vita belonged, in fact, to Calabrian clan boss Vincenta Alvaro. Alvaro had organized his business through many shell companies run by men of straw. Another type of laundering circuit is the Japanese ants. The Japanese mafioso gives some false tourists, the ants, a sum of dirty money and air tickets to Paris. The ants buy luxury items, leather goods, perfumes, haute couture. Back in Japan, the ants hand them to the trafficker and receive a small commission. The luxury goods go into the window of a boutique. Paris luxury goods, owned by the mafia. When they're sold, the circle is complete. Money laundering became more sophisticated in the 1980s. Franklin Gerardo was one of the architects of this new era. Financier of the Cartel of Cali, after studies at Harvard, Gerardo set up a circuit that still works today. Drug traffickers were amassing huge fortunes thanks to drugs. Gerardo split the process into two phases. It's simple, but you need to listen carefully. Let's say I'm a Colombian drug dealer. I travel to a Caribbean tax haven and deposit my suitcases of cash in a bank account. No one's the wiser. My dirty money is then transferred to another bank, in Germany perhaps, into the account of a front man. Now it begins to branch out. The money is transferred and circulates between dozens of ever more respectable banks. Across dozens or hundreds of bank accounts, in Monaco, Liechtenstein, Switzerland, or Austria, to avoid drawing attention to the banking authorities, the transfers are never over $10,000. For the second phase of the Gerardo cycle, I need to get the money back to Colombia. Through men of straw, I set up European companies. These will invest the laundered money in my name in restaurants and property in Colombia, quite legally. Dispersion, concealment, and globalization become the keys to criminal finance. It's hardly surprising that Gerardo's scheme began in the 80s. Under the influence of Thatcher and Reagan, a new ideology was preaching deregulation as the sine qua non of economic policies. Shady capitalism takes root. Finance becomes queen. It was a gift for people wanting to recycle dirty money. Criminal money swims like a fish in deregulated financial waters, following the currents used by money from political corruption and tax evasion. Currents that take it to places smelling of holidays and dirty money. The Cayman Islands and the Virgin Islands, Panama. But not just them. There are about 50 tax havens around the world where the money circulates nonstop. The spider's web of the illegal economy. John Christensen is a leader in the fight against tax havens. He knows them well. He was economic advisor to the government of Jersey for 11 years.
When I was working offshore in Jersey, in the finance world, the fees that I charged were much higher than anything one would charge working in normal, legitimate activity, because they're expecting higher fees, because they want you to work on their side. What they're paying you for is what the Swiss call discretion, what I would call secrecy. In other words, you are not going to cooperate with investigators. You're going to put every single barrier in the way of investigation. At one stage, I was investigating on behalf of a client, a gigantic petrol company. I was investigating one Russian company. They were thinking about doing a joint venture. And this company was set up with structures in Jersey, in Cyprus, in Switzerland, in Delaware, in the Netherlands, across a whole range of different tax havens. Nobody knew who owned that company. Nobody at all. We suspected, and we involved Russian intelligence in our investigations, we suspected that it belonged to the very highest levels politically in Russia at that time, the very highest levels. But we could never get the evidence. The evidence was, in fact, kept in a safe in a law office in Cyprus.
In Cyprus, Jersey and Monaco, at these counters of the black economy, silence is well rewarded. And nobody's complaining.
It corrupts the lawyers and the bankers and so on, because they are effectively colluding with criminals, and they know they're colluding with criminals, but the money's far too seductive to turn down.
In the secret world of international finance, nothing looks as clean as dirty money. The biggest money laundering centers are some of the most select towns in Europe. Tranquil Switzerland, for example. 30 kilometers of Zurich, the canton of Zug, is one of the flagships of financial obscurity. Over the years, the transnationals have set up their headquarters in Zug. Xstrata Glencore, or Transocean, leader in oil drilling, involved in the pollution of the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. Where is the criminal money in all this? In this faceless world of illegal capitalism, it's impossible to identify it. So fraud or blindness? There is another financial center that perfectly illustrates this outlaw capitalism where everything gets mixed up. It may be the atomic heart of a system out of control. London and its sacred enclave, the City of London, leading deregulation since the 1980s. All the players and tools of criminal finance are here, using all the methods of the classic hoodlums.
London is very attractive for money launderers on many, many fronts. And far better educated people than me have commented that London is the number one offshore tax haven in the world. We're offshore to Europe. We're having some interesting dialogue with Europe at the moment in relation to our financial services status. But we're also offshore to the rest of the world. And our Commonwealth heritage with the Cayman Islands, with the British Virgin Islands, with Belize and many other offshore jurisdictions, gives us quite a strong position.
If you look at many of these small islands, they have a shared characteristic, and that characteristic is their stamps carry the head of Britain's Queen there on the stamp. They fly the Union flag, and this isn't an accident. This has been part of the City of London's development strategy.
London, hub of the world's financial movements, whatever the color of the money.
If you can push your money into and take your money out of London, you once again have this appearance of legitimacy. If the money has been good enough for London, then it's good enough for anyone.
The international community has been fighting money laundering since the 1990s. An intergovernmental organization, the FAFT, has made a list of recommendations. Their calls for transparency have been quite ineffectual. The mafias aren't affected by the economic crisis. In fact, the current financial depression may well be a fabulous opportunity to consolidate their position. Faced with this major challenge of our time, our leaders seem to be either blind or resigned, or something more. Martin Woods has witnessed this deadly addiction. He was involved in the greatest money laundering scandal ever. In 2005, this ex-Scotland Yard man was engaged by the London branch of a big American bank, Wachovia. Woods soon identified clients linked to Casas de Cambio, the Mexican Money Exchange Bureau.
What we saw were large batches of traveler's checks, sequentially numbered, bearing illegible signatures, no dates, and critically, no identification features upon the rear of any of the checks to enable me to ascertain who it was who presented the checks. Back to basics, who was the customer? We couldn't see that.
Martin Woods alerted his bosses. He didn't know he was not alone. The U.S. federal authorities were also watching Wachovia, especially after the Mexican army intercepted a plane in 2006, hired by the cartel of Sinaloa. The plane was full of cocaine. The investigation showed it was bought with money passing through the Wachovia bank.
There were some bankers who were engaged in marketing this service to Casas de Cambio customers and providing banking services that were used to launder money. And when I confronted and challenged this, I was confronted, challenged, and even attacked by the bankers for my own conduct.
Despite the evidence gathered by Woods, the bank ignored this and directed all its criticisms towards him.
I didn't have support from my departmental bosses. In fact, I found no support there whatsoever. And it took the bank a long time to realize that money did not control me. Money did not influence me in the same way that it influenced them. And this was rarely emphasized when my boss telephoned me in 2009 to tell me that my bonus for 2008 was zero. That was a very defining moment.
The outcome of this exemplary story is Woods was fired. When the American justice system caught up with Wachovia in March 2010, it got off with a ridiculously low fine.
I cannot explain or understand why the Justice Department decided not to prosecute the Wachovia managers. Perhaps something is related to the crisis and the fear that after the collapse of a big bank in the U.S., Lehman Brothers, another big bank, Wachovia, would fail. That may be an explanation, but it may also show that the presence of mafia money is so strong that it has become irreversible and they are not even prosecuting.
In 2008, Wachovia was bought by a rival, Wells Fargo, which paid the bill, a fine of $150 million. Grotesque, when we know that in total, Wachovia laundered $378 billion, an astonishing sum, one-fifth of France's GNP.
I cannot, honestly, think of one single bank in the world that has not been touched by this problem. To an extent that some of my very militant colleagues who are concerned about all this say that it is not mafia looking for banks, it's banks looking for mafia money.
I think, you know, there were bankers who have to question themselves and perhaps should be questioned by authorities as to what they were doing. Ultimately, how close is a launderer's finger to the trigger of the killer's gun? Who knows?
While on the surface, we see that the integrity of banking and financial services depends heavily on the perception that it functions within a framework of high legal, professional, and ethical standards. And a reputation for integrity is one of the most valuable assets of a financial institution. The fact is that the policy of silence prevails, and criminal finance is shaping the economic, political, and social landscape of our modern world. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another Aperture. Goodbye for now.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, submission to Allah and self-reflection. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. To completely submit to someone is to lose all control. This is the first thought that comes to us when we get discussed about submitting to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, if we're going to submit, this means we don't have any control. It's a terrifying thought, I know. But ultimately, submission to the one who created you enfolds all the bliss, happiness, and knowledge you could ever dream of. All that you unknowingly need, because then He will be your compass. He will guide you and save you from yourself. When one commits a sin, small or big, they eventually end up reflecting. You know, you get this thought that I've made a mistake, I've done something that violates what Allah has said. Psychological research has shown that reflection is a critical component of general positivity in life. Reflection should consist of evaluating different parts of the same situation, evaluating your actions and their consequences, and learning how you could improve, not only for yourself, but also for others. One needs to be wary of reflection that focuses entirely on the ego and the self, as this type of reflection brings out narcissism and does more damage than good. You know, sometimes when we start reflecting, we become so self-centric that we become idle for ourselves, unfortunately. And this is where the narcissism takes birth. So remember, reflection is not to indulge you in self-love. This is a catch-22. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing submission to Allah and self-reflection. We said that anytime we violate what Allah has commanded us to do, there is this negative feeling that I have done something wrong. You know, this disgusting feeling that I've done something wrong. I've violated Allah's boundaries, right? And as a result of this, the process of reflection starts, right? And we said that there is a danger with reflection when you become too self-centric. However, in most cases, reflection helps individuals understand and cope with situations better because it allows them to analyze all that has happened. This reflection could last hours, days, or even weeks, which of course varies from person to person. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first infallible Imam, the commander of the faithful, is reported to have said the following: "Your remedy is within you, but you do not sense it. Your sickness is from you, but you do not perceive it. You presume you are a small entity, but within you is enfolded the entire universe. You are indeed the evident book by whose alphabet the hidden becomes manifest. Therefore, you have no need to look beyond yourself. What you seek is within you, if only you reflect." This is a best saying I have seen on the importance of reflection, self-reflection, knowing who you are. This is the pathway for some to get to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This recognition and reflection takes you to Allah, and this is where you are ready to submit to Allah. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the 20 years since the September 11 attacks, the United States regime has spent more than $21 trillion at home and overseas on militaristic policies that led to the creation of a vast surveillance apparatus, worsened mass incarceration, intensified the war on immigrant communities, and caused incalculable human suffering in Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, and elsewhere. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Since 9/11, U.S. has spent $21 trillion on militarism at home and abroad. Stay tuned for more. In the 20 years since the September 11 attacks, the United States has spent more than $21 trillion at home and overseas on militaristic policies that led to the creation of a vast surveillance apparatus, worsened mass incarceration, intensified the war on immigrant communities, and caused incalculable human suffering in Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, and elsewhere. According to State of Insecurity, the cost of militarization since 9/11, a report released recently by the National Priorities Project, the U.S. government's so-called war on terror has remade the U.S. into a more militarized actor both around the world and at home by pouring vast resources into the Pentagon, federal law enforcement, and the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, an agency established in response to the September 11 attacks. Released in the wake of the final withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan after two decades of devastating war and occupation, the new report argues that the Taliban's rapid takeover of the country raises deep questions about U.S. military investments to date. 20 years ago, we were promised a vision of the war on terror that did not come to pass, that Afghanistan would not become a quagmire, or that the Iraq war would be over in 5 weeks or 5 days or 5 months and cost a mere $60 billion, the report notes. Adding, as the country went to war and refocused domestic security spending on terrorism, few had any inkling of the far-reaching ramifications for the military, veterans, immigration, or domestic law enforcement. The National Priorities Project, NPP, an initiative of the Institute for Policy Studies, estimates that of the $21 trillion the U.S. invested in foreign and domestic militarization in the aftermath of September 11th, 2001, $16 trillion went to the military, $3 trillion to veterans programs, $949 billion to DHS, and $732 billion to federal law enforcement. In addition to fueling death and destruction overseas, the new report stresses that spending on overseas wars heightened domestic militarization, making police crackdowns on dissent at home even more violent. The analysis notes, there is evidence that the war on terror drove transfers of military equipment to police as arguments ended and the Pentagon looked to divest from surplus equipment. Transfers in 2010, when the military was still deeply engaged in the war on terror, totaled $30 million. Over the next few years, the U.S. pulled forces out of Iraq and military equipment transfers skyrocketed, peaking at $386 million in 2014. Today, transfers are still far higher than they were early in the War on Terror, totaling $152 million in 2020 and $101 million in just the first half of 2021. Lindsay Kashgarian, Program Director of NPP and lead author of the new report, said in a statement recently that our $21 trillion investment in militarism has cost far more than dollars. It has cost the lives of civilians and troops lost in the war, and the lives ended or torn apart by our brutal and punitive immigration, policing, and mass incarceration systems, said Kashgarian. Meanwhile, we have neglected so much of what we really need. Militarism hasn't protected us from a pandemic that, as its worst, took the toll of 9/11 every day, from poverty and instability driven by staggering inequality, or from hurricanes and wildfires made worse by climate change, unquote. According to the new report, it would have cost far less than $21 trillion for the U.S. to make major investments in climate action and other key global and domestic priorities. As the analysis notes, $4.5 trillion could fully decarbonize the U.S. electric grid. $2.3 trillion could create 5 million 15 per hour dollars job with benefits and cost living adjustments for 10 years. $1.7 trillion could erase student debt. $449 billion could continue the extended child tax credit for another 10 years. $200 billion could guarantee free preschool for every 3- and 4-year-old for 10 years and raise teacher pay, and $25 billion could provide COVID vaccines for the population of low-income countries. The NPP report was published on the same day that Brown University's Cost of War project released a new analysis estimating that U.S.-led post-9/11 wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere have killed at least 929,000 people, a figure deemed likely to be a vast undercount, and cost more than $8 trillion. Kashgarian said recently, the end of the war in Afghanistan represents a chance to reinvest in our real needs, adding, 20 years from now, we could live in a world made safer by investments in infrastructure, job creation, support for families, public health, and new energy systems, if we are willing to take a hard look at our priorities.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Venezuela's main opposition parties have announced an end to 3 years of boycotting elections. The country's opposition alliance, the so-called Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is led by the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido, announced on Tuesday that it would participate in the regional and municipal elections scheduled for November 21. President Nicolas Maduro has praised the move, as worthy of applause for returning to democracy. The opposition, however, said its participation would not mean that it believed the elections would be free or fair. The Alliance boycotted the 2018 presidential vote, which Maduro won, and the 2020 legislative elections, in which the opposition lost control of Congress. In both cases, it dismissed the elections as fraudulent. Its decision to end the boycott comes as government and opposition representatives are involved in talks, mediated by Norway and hosted by Mexico. The talks, which began last month, are aimed at resolving the political crisis that plagued the Latin American country after Guaido unilaterally declared himself interim president in January 2019. Back in 2019, Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president of Venezuela. Back then, the administration of former President Donald Trump, along with several European countries and a number of right-wing Latin American leaders, recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. The U.S. confiscated Venezuelan state assets in America in a bid to support Guaido.
They were doing things that really were undermining the autonomy and the sovereignty of Venezuela to have its own free and fair elections, and were committing acts which they had no right under any sort of international law to do. And so it just is a matter of time before the failure of all these events catches up to the United States and the Venezuelan opposition who it was working with.
The U.S. move was seen as an attempt to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela. That was not the first time the U.S. pushed for regime change in Venezuela. Back in 2002, during the presidency of George W. Bush, a coup was orchestrated against Venezuela's former president Hugo Chavez. The plot failed due to overwhelming popular support and mobilization against the coup. Washington has a long list of military interventions and coups in different Latin American countries. Venezuela is now one of the few countries in that region which is led by a left-wing anti-imperialist government. The U.S. push to oust Maduro's government is reminiscent of U.S. colonial moves in Latin America during the 20th century. The Food Assistance Agency of the UN has estimated that one out of every three Venezuelan is struggling to consume enough daily calories.
The United States has fully withdrawn its forces from Afghanistan to officially end 20 years of occupation. The invasion will be remembered for its colossal failures, unfulfilled promises, and a frantic final exit that cost the lives of scores of Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. military personnel. The final U.S. evacuation flight left Kabul Airport late on Monday. U.S. military officials say hundreds of Americans who have been left on Afghan soil will be transported out of the country in the coming days. A Taliban spokesman says the defeat of the United States in Afghanistan was a lesson for the invaders.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
More than 122,000 people have reportedly been evacuated from Kabul since August the 14th, the day before the Taliban took control of the country. U.S. President Joe Biden has come under immense criticism of his handling of the withdrawal. Nearly 90 retired U.S. generals and admirals have called for Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley to resign for their roles surrounding the chaotic pullout. The retired flag officers proposed what they felt should have happened in the withdrawal, including not rushing the pullout and not abandoning the Bagram Air Base and American weapons and military equipment in the hands of the Taliban.
The war in Afghanistan is now over. I'm the fourth president who has faced the issue of whether and when to end this war. When I was running for president, I made a commitment to the American people that I would end this war. Today, I've honored that commitment. It was time to be honest with the American people again.
Well, I don't believe the U.S. government has learned a lesson. The U.S. media certainly hasn't learned a lesson. Statements we've seen from Biden, for instance, have been that we've accomplished our goals in Afghanistan, which I think is furthest from the truth.
The US invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks under the pretext of so-called war on terror. According to estimates, America's longest war took the lives of nearly 2,500 US troops and an estimated 240,000 Afghans, and cost around $2 trillion US dollars. Thousands of Afghan civilians were also maimed during the years. The estimated interest costs of the war are expected to top $6.5 trillion by 2050.
I think the U.S. went in there 20 years ago, removed the Taliban, and now the Taliban is back, perhaps stronger than ever. It seems like it's an utter defeat for the United States.
The war has left Afghanistan in ruins and devastated the country's infrastructure. Just as Saigon marked the humiliating defeat of U.S. geostrategic ambitions in Indochina after 10 years of war and conflict in Vietnam, many analysts now believe Kabul marks the same humiliating defeat in Central Asia.
You know, after the Vietnam War, there was something they called the Vietnam Syndrome. The American people didn't want to go into that kind of war ever again. And I believe we're seeing the beginning of an Afghan syndrome. The American people think it was a mistake, don't want to see it again. The trillions of dollars that went into Afghanistan could have been used to help the Afghani people or for the American people.
The botched military occupation is likely to trigger a refugee crisis in the Middle East and beyond. When it comes to Afghanistan and the wider region, Washington and its allies have proved after two decades that they have nothing to offer but misery and despair. U.S. officials believed that a U.S.-trained, funded, and equipped Afghan army could hold the line against the poorly trained, funded, and equipped Taliban insurgency. But after a 20-year presence in Afghanistan, they still had little or no understanding of Afghan society and the power of Taliban militants.
Hundreds of Palestinians have staged protests against the Israeli regime's inhumane blockade of the Gaza Strip, burning tires and hurling explosive devices toward the fence between Gaza and the occupied territories for several consecutive nights. The Israeli military, which deployed additional troops along the fence ahead of the night protests, used live fire, tear gas, and stun grenades against Palestinian protesters. Several Palestinians have been injured by Israeli forces east of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry's spokesman, Ashraf Al-Kedra, said several others were hurt from tear gas canisters fired at them. During Saturday night's protests alone, 11 Palestinians were injured by live fire and other aggressive measures used by Israeli forces.
I mean, it's because the laws are not being implemented, they're not being penalized, they're not being punished for all these, violations of all these laws. So they feel like they have a green light to commit more crimes and more crimes. And this becomes a natural system for the Zionists. The Zionists now, they think that they're above the law and no law is going to, stop them from committing any crime that they want to do. And that's why you can see that whenever we hear condemnations from countries or even the nation's assemblies, there's nothing really coming out of it at the end of the day.
Gazans have been organizing protests since last week. They are demanding that the crossings be reopened to facilitate the entry of goods and humanitarian aid. In a statement on Sunday, the resistance committees in Palestine announced that the protests will continue until the Israeli regime